Let's go ahead and get our Bibles open back to Exodus chapter 15 today. Verse 22 is where we want to start. We've just seen the miraculous crossing of the Red Sea. Pharaoh's pursuit force totally wiped out, and Pharaoh has gone back to his place of reign with, as we'd say, his tail between his legs, and he will no longer hassle the Israelis. So they are quite pleased with how things have turned out, and they are ready now to move on toward Mount Sinai at a more relaxed pace. Now, I've told you before, I believe that the Feast of Unleavened Bread probably mirrored the time that Israel was making its very fast trip from Ramses in the land of Goshen until they arrived at the ambush site at the Red Sea, the Suez arm of it, I believe, and crossed it miraculously, seeing the destruction of the Egyptian army. And so I believe that all probably took about a week worth of time, which the Feast of Unleavened Bread is to be 1 week long. It starts on the 15th, which was the day that the Israelis left, and it finishes on the 21st. And so I think it's possible that the Israelis may have crossed the Red Sea somewhere toward the end of that first Feast of Unleavened Bread, perhaps on the 20th. I don't think it'd probably be on the 21st, the actual day that the feast ended, because they seem to be doing some traveling next to get to their next Sabbath site, their Sabbath rest, where they will perhaps stay for several days after they've rested. So, when we're picking up in Exodus 15, 22, I want you to remember that we've also got a parallel in Numbers 33 that lists the sites of Israel's journey. And so there will be some sites in the Numbers 33 passage that's not listed in our Exodus account. And I'll try to bring those in at the time. So Exodus 15, 22 says, "Then Moses made Israel set out from the Red Sea," or as I've been explaining, the Gulf of Suez arm of the Red Sea, "and they went into the wilderness of Shur." Shur has something to do with a wall. And I've talked about this before, that it's possible that the Egyptians had a series of forts that stretched along the eastern side of the delta down toward Gulf of Suez, and that this was a military wall, which then lent its name to this desert region right here on the northwest corner of the Sinai Peninsula. But I think it's more likely that Shur is a reference to the wall where the mountainous portions of the Sinai give way to the more flat, relatively speaking, and shifting sand dunes that are between the mountainous portions of Sinai and the green portions of the delta. And you can actually see this if you pull up something like Google Earth. You can see the more flat, sandy areas as highlighted against the wall of Sinai's interior. So I believe that they left the area near what is the modern port of Suez and headed east and then tended southeast toward what is the modern-day port of Aqaba that is on the north tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, because that is part of the ancient highway system that went across the Sinai. It is also the route that takes us to Midian, where we know Mount Sinai is actually located. All right, so back to the text. They went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. Now, how fast are they traveling? I don't know. In some of the things that I've just kind of sketched out in my my chronological notes, giving suggestions, they could have crossed the Sinai and got to where I think Mount Sinai is located, averaging 10 miles between their encampment sites, or 10 miles to a day as their average traveling. So if that's the case, then 3 days travel into the wilderness is only about 30 miles or so. They could have certainly gone faster than that, but they have no reason to be moving along at a brisk pace anymore because no one's chasing them. The bigger key to what this verse is telling us is that when they arrived at this next site, which I think is where they set up for their next Sabbath rest, is there was no water at this location, at least not potable water, drinkable water. Verse 23, when they came to Mara, they could not drink the water of Mara because it was bitter. And the word for bitter in Hebrew is Mara. You can see that in the book of Ruth, by the way. It's used there. Therefore, that site was called Mara. The people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" See, we're out here in a wilderness where it doesn't rain, and there's no really big springs in all these different places. There are some oases that you've got to know exactly where they're at, but we've come to this oasis, and the water here is not drinkable. It's nasty. What are we supposed to do about that? So now we see the Israeli attitude that predominates throughout the wilderness wanderings, and that is grumping and griping and complaining and murmuring and not trusting either Moses or God. So Moses has been grumped at, so what does he do? He goes to God about it. Verse 25, he cried to He Who Is, and He Who Is showed him a log, and he threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. Now, this is not some sort of natural fixing of the problem. He is not throwing some sort of tree log that he's aware of that can kind of decontaminate bitter waters. God is using this as a faith mechanism, as a physical thing that Moses can toss in there and say, all right, God is using this to fix the water for you. So he does it. And there He Who Is made for them a statute and a rule, and there he tested them, saying, if you will diligently listen to the voice of He Who Is your God, and do that which is right in His eyes, and give ear to His commandments, and keep His statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you that I put on the Egyptians, for I am He Who Is your healer. So God, through Moses, through Aaron, tells the Israelites, I am trying to check your attitudes here, because what I need you to do is trust me. If you come across bitter water, trust that I can give you sweet water instead. If you come to a place where there is no water, trust me, I can provide water where there is no water. If you come to a place where there's no food, trust me, I can provide food. And in the case of these illnesses, God says, if you will just trust me, you won't come under my plague hand. I will not have to discipline you and your attitude like I had to discipline the Egyptians and their bad attitude. And then in some of the older English versions, this is where you come across the title Jehovah Jireh, or the use of the divine name followed by the Hebrew word for healing. Excuse me, it's not Jehovah Jireh, that's my help. It's Jehovah Rapha. There we go. So in this case, it is He who is your healer. He who is Rapha, your healing one. And Rapha can be the base word for Raphadim that appears in some other places later. All right, so God is trying to help the Israelis to trust Him in every incident. Verse 27, then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they camped there by the water. I believe that this is likely to be another Sabbath encampment, and that's how I present it as a, I think I use possible, chronological indicator as we're going through the chronological companion to the Bible that I've written out as my chronological outline to Scripture. Elim, the word here, means palm trees. So it gets its name after the fact that they arrived at this oasis that has 12 independent springs and 70 palm trees that are growing up around these springs. And there is great symbolism in that because the Israelis came to Egypt with 70 named persons. 70 seems to be the number of elders or leaders of the Israelis as a whole. That becomes the basis for the Sanhedrin. So perhaps they saw in this something significant in God being trustworthy. So this is the next campsite, and I think they stay there probably about a week. Chapter 16. They set out from Elim, or palm trees, and all the congregation, or all of the assembly of the Israelis, and in the Greek Old Testament, this is the word synagogue, because the synagogue in Greek means to be gathering together. So the whole congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin. Now, I know we usually say sin because we're used to seeing this word meaning a sin, but it's actually Sin, and it has to do with, I believe, the ancient world god of the moon. You will see it listed as a thorn in some places, but I think we've got more of the issue of the ancient peoples worshipped the moon. So they came into this wilderness, which is between Elim and Sinai, which takes its name from this shorter form. So some of your helps will say that Mount Sinai is basically Mount Thorny. But I think it's possible that it is actually the Mount of the Moon that was the original name of the peoples living near there. The Midianite name seems to be Horeb, because remember that was the name of the place where Moses was shepherding the sheep of his father-in-law, and Horeb has to do with desolate or wilderness. All right, so they set out from Elim, which is somewhere in the modern-day Sinai Peninsula, and they head to the wilderness of Sin. Now, there is, in the Numbers 33 passage, at least one other site between these two. And so let me read to you from that. Numbers 33:10. They set out from Elim, that is palm tree area, and then they camped by the Red Sea. Now this is important. The Red Sea has two arms on it. The western arm we call today the Gulf of Suez. That's the one I believe they crossed miraculously. The other arm, the eastern arm of the Red Sea, is what we call today the Gulf of Aqaba. And I believe that's the place that's being referenced in Numbers 33:10, that they were camping somewhere near the head, near the northern part of the Gulf of Aqaba. And so that gives us that nice direction between the two places. It's a basically southeasterly trip along an ancient highway to get to this point, and it would have been the path from the delta of Egypt to Midian, which is located on the eastern side of the Gulf of Aqaba. So we are right exactly on track here. Verse number 11 of Numbers 33 says, "And then they set out from the Red Sea, and they camped in the wilderness of Sin." So now we are in an area on the eastern side of the Gulf of Aqaba line. If you take a line and go from the Gulf of Aqaba up to the Dead Sea, we are now east of that line. And so that's one of the reasons, again, that I say the traditional site for Mount Sinai down in the southern tip of the Sinai Peninsula is totally wrong. Doesn't matter that it's got long-standing tradition going back to the time of Constantine's mom, Helena, who was apparently a very devoted Christian. She was in the wrong place when she visited there and thought it was Mount Sinai. Doesn't matter that it goes back into several centuries before Christ, that some of the Jewish people thought that that was where Mount Sinai was located. It wasn't. Because it needs to be near Midian, which is east of the Gulf of Aqaba. All right, so we've now arrived within a few miles, about 30-some miles or so, of what I believe is the possible site for Mount Sinai. And we have another problem that's going to arise, but we also have a nice chronological notation. Chapter 16, they set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, or Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from the land of Egypt. So that tells us they have been traveling for 4 weeks now. And that's why I suggest that there have been four Sabbath encampments since they left on the 15th day of the first Jewish month. Verse 2, "And the whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the people of Israel said to them, 'Would that we had died by the hand of he who is in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out of this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. So what's happened? Because they've traveled for a month, for 4 weeks, they are now out of all the supplies of food that they left Egypt with. They don't have any more grain to grind up and make their daily bread. And so they think they are going to now starve to death because they're out in the middle of nowhere with their supplies running out. So we have, again, an indicator of their lack of trust, their lack of faith, and how they so very quickly revert to attacking Moses and saying it's all his fault, that it would have been better if we had died in the plagues, because at least we would have died full of food. But you've brought us out here so that we can die of hunger. Verse 4. Then he who is said to Moses, "Behold, I am about to rain bread from heaven for you. And the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not." Now that is a tie-in, that line in verse number 4, to Deuteronomy chapter number 8. And you know what? I think we actually ought to go there, because this is a passage that Jesus quotes from whenever he was being tested to turn stones into bread in his wilderness experience. So in Deuteronomy chapter number 8, Moses is going back over the story of the Exodus, reminding them of everything that's happened up at this point and how they need to trust God. And so in chapter 8, it says, "The whole commandment that I command you today, you shall be careful to do, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land that he who is swore to give to your fathers. You shall remember the whole way that he who is your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness, that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. He humbled you," which means he put you in a rough situation, "and let you hunger, and then fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of he who is." So here in Exodus chapter 16, God is giving a lesson that the reason you guys are where you're at as you're running out of food supplies is because I want you to understand you can trust me. Do it. Just trust me. I will provide for you. Now, the thing about a test is that it can be, when it's somebody that has your best interest in mind, to be a growing experience. That's what is intended. But because of the hardness of certain people's hearts, a time of testing can also be a time that arouses the negative core attitude that resides in certain people's. So it becomes a trap to lead to sin. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why in the New Testament, in the Greek language, the word for test and the word for temptation is the same word. But context is always going to dictate what was intended by it. I'm going to quickly remind you of one of my favorite memory verses that I think every last one of you ought to know, 1 Corinthians 10:13. And it says that we are not tempted when we find ourselves tempted beyond that which we are able, because God is faithful. That means he can be trusted in that he will not allow us to be tempted or tested beyond what we are able, but with that temptation or testing, he will provide a way of escape that we may be able to endure it. So here is an illustration of that reality. God brought them to this place where their rations run out because he can provide for them and he needs them to trust him. Verse number 5. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily. So God says, I'm about to provide them with what will function as bread. I'm going to provide it every single day of the week, except on the sixth day, I'm going to give them a double portion because I want them to take the seventh day off and rest. So this is where God is preparing them for the appearance of manna for the very first time. It is also likely to be the source of one of the lines in the model prayer that Jesus gave. And that is that when we pray, our Father who is in heaven, holy is your name. And then we get to the line that says, give us this day our daily bread, our bread that we need for the day. That's going to go back to this time period when Israel learned every day you have to trust God. You can't take a day off from that. And I think we as Christians, as the heirs of this salvation, need to learn that lesson and put it into practice every single day. So when you see a time of trouble coming on the horizon, don't give up. Trust God.